Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast, covering emerging topics and challenges in the fields of probiotics, prebiotics, synbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. This is the podcast of the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, known as ISAP, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of these fields. Check us out at www.isapscience.org. I'm Dr. Mary Ellen Sanders, ISAP's Executive Science Officer. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi from UC Davis.
And on today's podcast, we're joined by Sarah Labeer, who's a professor of microbiology at the University of Antwerp in Belgium. So, Sarah, you're very welcome.
Hello, everyone.
Sarah, can you start by telling us, how did you get into this field? How did you end up working in the field of probiotic mechanisms? I mean, it's a fascinating area and you're making a huge contribution, I think. But how did you end up here?
Actually, from the beginning of my academic career, when I had to choose a master thesis topic, I had the choice between a master topic on Salmonella pathogenesis research and trying to find pathogenesis factors, or a novel topic on lactobacilli and how to find probiotic factors and novel modes of action. And I choose the most difficult topic on the lactobacilli.
Yeah, I agree, because I mean, it's so difficult. It's difficult enough to do any kind of research, but to show a beneficial effect of a bacterium is so much more difficult than showing a pathogenic effect, I think.
Indeed, that's actually the end result. I think I was very naive and I was young, and I really believed that we could pinpoint modes of action or beneficial molecules, and that turned out to be much more complex than I thought in the beginning.
Why do you think that is?
I think just by definition, how to define health and how to define that someone becomes healthier, it's very difficult. So it's also very difficult to measure health and to have good biomarkers of health. While I still remember the beginning, and if you put a salmonella on a cell line, your cells will die and you will see inflammation, you will see ILH going up, and it's very clear phenotype. While if you put a lactobacillus on the same cell line, you want to see the improvement of the barrier function, but it's much more subtle. So it's also much more difficult to measure and to see significant effects.
And I guess the area that you're working in, and many of us try and work in this area, the way to resolve that is really to get at mechanism, isn't it?
Yeah, I think mechanisms are also so crucial in our field, and also to help people understand how probiotics and the microbiome interact. But I think the most difficult thing is how to translate the mechanism into things we can measure, and how to translate a concept that you need, that often a probiotic works via multifactorial modes of action, and how to measure that and design experiments to define that and to outline that.
Now, I guess we've even learned that with pathogens. I mean, I remember a long time ago when I learned about pathogens, it was just, you know, Salmonella invades cells and that's how it causes its damage. And now we know there must be hundreds of Salmonella virulence factors all working together to make this happen, to make this deleterious effect on health happen. So it's not surprising to learn that you think probiotics is not going to be as simple as well as a probiotic produces something and that makes you healthier. It's going to be this multifactorial kind of approach.
Indeed. Yeah, it's fascinating that you say that also in pathogens, it's this complex, because I still often think it's that way. But you're right. If you see now all the papers coming out for pathogens, it's also much more complex than previously thought.
Sarah, I wonder, you know, because you have the engineering and technology development background, do you think of mechanism as something that you'd like to understand just because it'll help you develop better applications? Or has that now become trying to figure that out its own reward? It's not so much developing the technology, it's really understanding the particular mechanisms.
It's a very good question. I think both are important. I'm a bioscience engineer, and I think knowing the key molecules is still crucial to make better products. I think the best example from my own research is, for example, that we found out that the LGG model probiotic needs pili to attach to cells, and it, just by paying attention that if you centrifuge, they're not sheared off, you can really make better probiotics, or you promote adhesion. But it's not the only molecule that is necessary, because then if they attach well, then all the other molecules are also coming closer to the surface of the host cell. So it's the whole combination. So I think both from a technology point of view, it's important to know the mechanism of action. Also from a regulatory point of view, I think the more you know, it's also the better you can describe it. And also from a clinical point of view, also for the clinicians, if they know better which patients could benefit from a certain probiotic, and probably there may also even matter many other viewpoints that it can be of interest.
Do you ever wonder, Sarah, you know, you've got a bacterium, let's say a bifidobacterium, and it's in the human gut and it's eliciting some functionality that is improving human health. And we pull that bifidobacterium out of the gut, we grow it in the lab and we freeze it in the minus 80 freezer, and then we grow it in the lab again, and then we grow it in stainless steel fermenters and we package it in tablets. We're essentially almost getting it to unlearn everything it knew about living in the gut. And then we throw it back into the gut and we say, no, elicit that health benefit again. Is it a very naive kind of approach? Or maybe do we just not have any alternative?
Yeah, of course, it's indeed a naive approach. And it's something you always need to take into account. So it's very important that the passages of your stock are not too long, and that you don't promote adaptation to the lab, because you still want your microbes to be adapted to the host or to the gut or something. Luckily, most of the time, the genetic potential is still there. But yeah, you also have epigenetic effects and so on. So I think it's important to take that into account, and also the context from where your beneficial microbes, it's isolated from it. Maybe it needs other microbes or certain host factors to promote its health benefits. So that's also, also the new direction the research is going into, not only looking at the microbe as such or the probiotic by itself, but also the context and the ecological context.
Yeah, I'm often fascinated by the fact that some of the best evidence for gut microbes, for example, comes from fecal transplants. And that's one case where they haven't been de-educated, if you like. They're still almost in the environment they came from. They're not grown in the lab. They're not grown in fermenters. They're not packaged. And I know they don't always work. Of course, fecal microbiota transplants only work in certain conditions. But they tend to be able to transfer phenotypes, you know, where you take fecal material from a donor and give it to a mouse. The mouse can sometimes exhibit some of the phenotypes of the person that the feces came from. And I wonder, is that because we haven't yet essentially grown the traits out of the organisms by the time you put them back in?
Yeah, I think it's one of the reasons. But then again, also the other reason is that it's always a multifactorial mode of action, and you have the whole complex community with its metabolites and maybe some other host factors and even phages, and all these molecules are co-transferred. So you acknowledge the fact that it's a complex mode of action, and you use the complex system to transfer.
Can you talk about, for our audience of educated people that may not know specifics about the mechanism, some of the main mechanisms by which probiotics, what are some of the main ways that these little microorganisms convey health benefit?
I always try to summarize that there are five main modes of action for probiotic mechanisms. And actually that helps me to summarize all the different studies that have been done with single molecules and so on. But I think you can summarize it as follows, that the first main mechanism is that probiotics can inhibit pathogens, or they can promote the growth of beneficial microbes through all kinds of metabolic interactions. For example, a key antimicrobial molecule for me is lactic acid, which is produced by many lactic acid bacteria, and it can really inhibit the growth of many pathogens, such as, for example, Salmonella. And then the other way around, we also see that certain metabolites being produced by probiotics, even again, like lactic acid, can be used by butyrate-producing bacteria, and in this way also have health benefit. So that's mechanism number one.
Can we pause there, Sarah, and just kind of expand that a little bit? To do that, you know, for a bacterium, a probiotic, to get into the gut and then almost change its environment by producing a substrate or a metabolite or producing an antimicrobial factor, it would have to be, I assume, quite active and quite abundant to be able to do that. Is there evidence that probiotics really do grow and metabolize and change the environment of the microbiome when they get there?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And that's also very difficult to measure, although I see an increasing number of publications also with sensors being done, like the short chain fatty acids or even lactic acid you can measure in situ. And I also think, I'm not sure whether they have to produce everything in situ at the site of action. I think, for example, lactic acid, lactobacillus is loaded by lactic acid. So the pills you've been taking already contain a lot of lactic acid, and then it will be released. And actually, that's also something we saw in our lab, is even sometimes when they died during the transfer, the metabolites are being released and they're also being used by the other microbes. So they don't always need to consume the available metabolites inside a colon, for example, to be active there.
A lot of people think, they just assume maybe, or maybe they read it somewhere, that, you know, they think the probiotics have to colonize and reach high numbers in the gut. You're almost putting these probiotics in to compete almost with your gut microbiota, but generally probiotics don't colonize. So what you've just said there explains why they could still work though in that, by that means.
I think that's a very important misinterpretation of a probiotic mode of action. I think colonization and a lot of growth inside the gut is not a main mode of action of all the studies I have seen. I think it's the high dose of microbes you apply that has a mode of action. And I also think it's important to consider local effects. Maybe they're not really abundant or overgrowing the resident microbes. That will not happen, but they can have local effects if they come into contact with local host cells like epithelial cells or Paneth cells, and you can see some mode of action there, and then they don't need to be in high numbers. It's the same with pathogens, that they also don't need to be in high numbers to have an effect.
And do you think most of those effects then would be in the small intestine? Because the colon is a long way away and a lot of those molecules might have diluted out by the time you get there.
Yeah, I think so, yes. Based on my own research, but also on what I have seen in the literature, I think the main mode of action is inside the small intestine. Also, the mucus layer is less thick and you have more contact with cells.
We've talked a lot about the interactions between the microbes. What are some of the other ways that the probiotic can benefit health?
Yeah, I think for me, mechanism number two and number three are a little bit similar. So they interact with host cells. And for mechanism two, they interact with epithelial cells, which are really at high. Yeah, you always have a lot of epithelial cells inside your gut or even on other mucosal surfaces. And then
what you mean by mechanism two is like promoting mucosal barrier function, I think.
Yeah. And what we see is really that if a probiotic, if you can put it on us, for example, an epithelial cell, you can see that tight junctions or specific proteins are being enhanced that promote a barrier function. So you really have a better closure of your barrier and a better functioning of your epithelial cells, and that you can really follow in the lab that this signaling effect is happening.
Do you think, Sarah, this happens in tissues other than the gut? I know you work on urogenital tract and on vaginal microbiome and things like that. Do you think?
Yeah, we also see that on, for example, skin cells and vaginal cells. And the pathways seem to be similar. So you often have really detection via certain receptors such as toll-like receptors and then pathways being induced. So it, of course, it always depends a little bit on the host cell physiology and architecture, but the mechanisms are somewhat similar.
Yeah, it's amazing we have these interactions, just the mucosal layers with this very dirty environment in our body and trying to keep things that come in where they want. What are the other ways that the probiotics can help with that immune response beyond the barrier function?
Yeah, then the epithelial cells, they're used to come into contact with bacteria anyway. But then you also have immune cells, which are more prone to react to certain microbes. And there you can also fine-tune their responses with probiotics. For example, you can reduce inflammatory responses because you send signals to tolerate the incoming microbes. Or you can also even promote through certain dendritic cells, you can promote specific responses of other immune cells which are underneath. And then you can even translate what is sensed locally to more systemic immune responses throughout the whole body, because immune cells are sensing what's happening in the gut or on the mucosal surface, and they send signals to the immune system. So that's also an important mode of action.
And the immune system, I love that there was a paper by Mikhail Clearbazum some time ago now, but showing, I think they had volunteers take three different probiotics in a kind of a, take one probiotic, a washout, take the next. And they actually did biopsies and sampled the kind of immune response, the local response in the gut, and saw three completely different responses to three different probiotic strains. I think it's a wonderful example of how the immune system has no difficulty in discriminating between different bacteria that are coming in and reacting differently to them. It's not just, oh, there's a bacterium, I'll do this. They can react very specifically to different bacteria.
Yeah, and I think that the interaction with immune cells is one of the most strain-specific responses to probiotics. And indeed, it's a beautiful example paper where they show that some probiotics have more an adjuvant activity. So what they do is they stimulate your immune system and they make you more alert towards certain functions. And other probiotic strains, they have rather the opposite response and they make you more tolerogenic and they make you tolerate incoming microbes more. So that's actually also my ultimate dream, or with a lot of other scientists, is if we could predict that better, what would happen, then we can really tailor probiotic responses or applications.
Do you think at some time in the future, people might even use like inert carriers, but decorate them with the kind of outer surface structures of probiotics and deliver them? Do you think would it be the same? Or do you think the fact that the probiotic is actually living is an essential part of its mode of action in terms of immune interaction?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And that's also something we have reviewed for the postbiotic consensus paper, is which mode of actions need live microbes and which modes of action are also happening with dead microbes or microbial components. And I think just from a molecular point of view, the interaction between microbial molecules or microbial associated molecular patterns and immune receptors can also happen with dead cells or even parts of the cells. And probably you will be better able to predict the response if you use this more artificial combinations. The biggest problem to me is that how to preserve the integrity of all these molecules and also the correct conformation, because for an immune response, it's also very important how they are presented. And if you have a whole bacterial cell with a biomass, then they're always presented to the immune cell in probably in the correct way, or in a way that promotes immune response. While if it's our small molecules dispersed, and then the conformation will be different. So it's something to be checked.
Yeah, it's not a very scientific observation I'm going to make, but I think, you know, life kind of seeks out life as well. And so a living organism in the gut is more likely, I think, to end up in the mucus or end up at the epithelial surface, or maybe it just kind of grows and expands and produces more. I hope that, you know, it's a situation where you couldn't replicate the function of a probiotic just by an inert carrier of some surface molecules or something. But that remains to be seen, of course.
Yeah, I agree. I think also that a live microorganism will be more natural, or will follow the natural pathways in a better way than something we make artificial. I think you will never be able to fully understand, so we will never be able to fully replicate what is necessary to have a good immune response.
Sarah, can you give some examples of modulation of metabolic responses by probiotics? Like, that's one of the other mechanisms that you have pointed out.
Yeah, that's a good point. So the first three mechanisms, like just inhibiting pathogens or promoting epithelial barrier function or stimulating immune responses, were the three main modes of action I had in the beginning from my research. But then you have an increasing number of publications coming out that, yeah, probiotics can also have really metabolic health effects and have, for example, impacts insulin resistance or reduce cholesterol levels in the blood. And then we start to realize that it's also important to take that into account when you study modes of action. For example, the enzyme bile salt hydrolase, which is produced by many lactobacilli, it has an enzymatic activity that can help reducing cholesterol levels, or some other metabolites. Histamine, for example, is also produced by many probiotics, which has a direct metabolic response. Tryptophan compounds derived from amino acids also seem to be having a very metabolic response, which is also, for me, a really novel, fascinating area in modes of action research on probiotics.
Do you think probiotics could work in a kind of through the endocrine system? Do you think they could produce peptides that would almost act as hormones and, you know, signal in that way to the body?
Yeah, definitely. I think just mechanistically or molecularly, they can produce peptides because they produce a lot of metabolites. So if they produce the correct active peptides, then they can indeed have this endocrine function.
So that's maybe maybe that falls under the modulation of metabolic responses in your scheme. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, more systemic responses. And I think if they are being taken up or they are being sensed, then the signaling will go to the whole body and you see these more systemic responses. So not only local responses inside the gut.
And for the fifth mechanism of action, neurological signaling, I'm curious, throughout your career, you've done a lot of great work with lactobacilli. Is that a mechanism that swam into your ken as you were studying it, or did you know about it from the very beginning when you were first doing your PhD?
Yeah, again, it's a novel mechanism. I didn't expect that. And it's something that other groups have found out, that there are some specific lactobacilli strains, sometimes also species, that can produce certain neurotransmitters like even GABA or histamine is sometimes also considered a more neurologically active compound.
I think a lot of serotonin is produced in the gut, right?
Yeah, also. And that's also fascinating research and which enzymes are responsible for that and how we can now mine genomes to see which species and strains are best for certain neurological effects. The gut-brain axis is something that is really becoming important. So that's also fascinating research.
I wonder, do you think there might be some other mechanisms that we haven't even contemplated yet, but that we're going to learn more about as new technology for studying and seeing the action inside the gut emerges?
Yeah, definitely. I think this, my five main modes of action are also just a way to help me conceptualize what's happening, because so many complex interactions are happening and it's just a way to classify. But I think each time something novel is being found, and we'll have to see, does it fit into one of the five main modes of action, or maybe it's a novel mechanism that also requires attention. And it's good to always be open and think outside the box and also look for what's happening in pathogenicity research. I think we can often be inspired by that. And also all these omic approaches, they also help us understand novel modes of action.
And you gave us a lovely view there of five different ways in which a probiotic, an introduced bacterium, could influence host health. But of course, they're doing it in an environment where we're already full of microbes. And presumably those microbes also can elicit these kind of effects. And so it sounds like the gut must be an incredibly noisy environment for a probiotic to get a signal across and make a difference. How do you think they do that? Is it just a numbers game?
I think it's definitely a numbers game, but then also some specific molecules also can be important. One of the fascinating experiments from my own team was when we did an experiment with LGD, the model probiotic, and then we changed one gene. We knocked out a specific cell surface molecule in the LTA molecule. We changed one gene and we just changed actually the charge of the LTA. And in a model for gut inflammation, in a DSS colitis model, this mutant had totally the opposite host response. So it reduced inflammation while the wild type increased inflammation. So all the rest was the same. So the same dose of probiotics. So just changing one gene can really change the host response, which is still very fascinating. And we don't understand why. So I think it's a numbers game, but also then, of course, also specific molecules also can play a role.
Dan touched on postbiotics right at the start. These are, of course, inanimate microbes that cause a health benefit. Do you think they can also cause all five of these levels, or do you think they're more likely to be restricted to a smaller subset of those mechanisms that you talked about for live bacteria?
Yeah, that's a very good question. In the beginning, I thought they will have lesser modes of action because they're not viable or they're inanimate. But I think it depends on the way they are inactivated. And if their integrity is rather preserved and they keep all the active molecules, they, in theory, they're capable of doing these five main modes of action. But like, for example, for the fifth mechanism or the metabolic responses, if you disrupt, it will be very difficult to keep the enzymes active. And then they still need to be active in the small intestine or in the large intestine. It will be difficult. But maybe if they find a very good way of preserving that, then they could still have this mode of action. The same with inhibiting pathogens. I think it will probably be best if the probiotics are live, and with postbiotics will be difficult, but maybe if they're overloaded with lactic acid and some bacteria sins, they can still have an antimicrobial mode of action. So the formulation will have to be very good, but it's possible.
So Sarah, you do a lot of work in the gut, which is really difficult, but you also do work in other environments that I wonder if you think they're easier or not, like crop protection and so on. And are there any kind of interplays between what you learn in one environment and what you learn in another environment?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I do indeed believe that the work outside the gut is a little bit easier, or that's just in what we discussed before, is just getting access to the site of action. It's easier if you have a skin or a nose or a vagina. Even for vagina, you just take a swab and you have much more access to all the metabolites in the site of action. So that helps a lot in mechanistic research. And also for me, one of the most difficult things with the gut is that diversity and the complexity of the microbiome is so difficult. So it's very difficult to predict that. And that's much more easy, for example, in the vagina, there you have the less diverse the vagina is the better for health. And there, even there, you need just need a dominance of lactobacilli. So from a probiotic point of view, that's easier to modulate and to study. And so, yeah, I agree a little bit that the gut is very complex. So good luck with all the people doing studying modes of action in the gut.
Well, Sarah, I'm really glad that you're doing it because we need people of your caliber doing this kind of work. And the advances you're making are just, yeah, they're changing the field. So thank you so much for all your work. And thank you for joining us today. We've really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much for the nice questions.